The truth is the thing in its absolute nature. Truth is that which is, regardless of seeming or appearing. Truth is therefore that which can penetrate all seemingness, or things as they appear to be, to the discovery of absolute reality as it actually is. The truth of a thing is therefore the total fact of the thing, its nature, its essence, its substance, its purpose, its origin, and its destiny. Under such condition, truth is not overly abundant. But what we commonly refer to as the truth is merely the fact of a thing on the level of physics, not on the level of metaphysics. Yet a fact bears witness in a strange, shadowy way to a truth. And that which is a fact in matter must be a truth in energy. So we have this nature of truth itself, and how man may or should regard himself as capable of participating in truth. The answer lies that at the abstraction of metaphysics, at the ultimate of essence itself, or being, we have that which is. Between that and the present state of man with his imperfect faculties is the universe of things as they seem to be. Wisdom dictates that man must gradually penetrate seemingness, must gradually outgrow delusion by appearance, must ultimately overcome any prejudice, conceit, or deceit within his own nature by which his judgment or his reason may be impaired. And it is then assumed that to the degree that man is absolutely reasonable, he comes closer to that which is absolutely true. He will not reach it because he cannot be absolutely reasonable. But he can improve his present lot considerably by even a modicum of hard mental exercise. He can know much more that is true than he now knows. And he can also rescue himself from addiction to that which is not true, which he has not yet learned to recognize as not true. So we have in our second problem this effort to define truth. If being exists, truth exists, because truth and being must be regarded finally as qualities exceedingly similar, if not identical. If there is a being, this being can be known, and that knowing is truth. But at any given time, or at any given condition, the creatures evolving within the substance of being, and possessing incomplete and imperfect faculties, may not be able to experience the actual fact of truth itself. So we are truth seekers, or we are wisdom lovers, which is the friendliness toward wisdom, which is the meaning of the term philosophy or philosophia, friendship for truth. But we cannot claim that we possess it. But if being exists, we cannot deny the truth exists. Therefore, we must gradually, as we can, overcome the interval or reduce the interval between our own comprehension and the essential reality that can conceivably be comprehended. This takes us to that phase of the problem which we say the nature of knowledge. The nature of knowledge is the nature of the attained. And what an individual knows may be considered as the substance of his attainment. Knowledge is relative. Truth is finally infinite or absolute. Consequently, it is not possible for us really to refer to relative truth, although we do it. What we really mean, probably, is that we are dealing with relative degrees of knowledge, for the truth itself cannot change. That part of truth which we comprehend, we call knowledge. Therefore, a knowing person is a person who knows something about truth, but does not know truth per se. A person of knowledge is a person who has become familiar or expert in some area, which is itself an area of truth. Actually, philosophy does not recognize any essential difference between sacred and profane knowledge. The individual who learns the Latin language is learning something, which in one way or another is an attainment in knowledge toward truth. Something is conferred here, more than the mere ability to speak a language. All mastery of things unknown or unmastered may be considered advancement toward universal knowledge. For knowledge is that part which we do know. And upon knowledge, we have built the civilization and universe as we comprehend it today. It is knowledge that has given us our arts and sciences, our industries, our crafts, and our trades. It is knowledge which has given us a certain expertness in the areas where physics itself operates. It is knowledge also which has caused us to extend the sovereignty of our own purposes as far as possible out into the universal existence. It is knowledge that may sometime land a spaceship on the moon or on the distant planet. But all this knowledge is on a level, and it is within the area of physics. In other words, it is in the area of material things, which to some degree at least are comprehended by the concrete faculties of the mind. We are extending our search out further and further along these rays that seem to emanate from absolute truth itself. Each of these is a pathway. We begin at the outer extremity or circumference of this radiance and move gradually toward its center. That which we have yet not reached, we look forward to and approach in terms of the unknown. That which we have conquered, that which we have mastered, that which we have transformed from the state of being unknown to the state of being known, we call knowledge. So as we proceed, knowledge increases. Theoretically, that brings us closer to universal knowing. Thus, we may say simply that all true knowledge must be in conformity with the laws of being, must be a revelation of being in one of its conditioned aspects, and therefore, by specialization, one of us may go further in music and another in art. But all of these accomplished are possible because of being. And being is released or revealed in some way through all of the conditioned accomplishments which are possible in nature or for man. So for simple purposes, the truth is divided into the known and the unknown. The known is knowledge. The unknown is the vast area yet to be conquered by the material powers of man to a certain point, and beyond that, by the rational, reasonable, intuitive, or inspirational powers of man. Now, this carries us naturally to the next point. What is energy? To the classical thinker, energy is simply a conditioned kind of life. Life within itself is like a great ocean. Life in itself has its currents and its tides and its seasons. But in its own nature, it is in eternal suspension. But when life, for one purpose or another, is caused to be objectified, when this life principle itself becomes the mover of things, when this life principle begins its vast pattern of circulation, by means of which it causes things to have existences within being, we call this energy. Energy is the power within the thing by which it lives. And the particular problem of energy is therefore the aliveness of a thing and the expansion of that thing from within itself by processes of growth, by which we also imply processes of evolution and ultimately processes of generation, or the transmission of life from one generation to the next. Energy, therefore, is that by which we are internally vitalized. Now, if in the course of this energizing, the individual is caused or moved to an action, this action becomes an aggressive expression of energy. And where energy is turned from the self to that which is not the self, as in the conquest of environment, or as a means of preserving or perpetuating its physical existence in a universe of conflicting energy, when this occurs, when energy moves the thing rather than moving within the thing, we term energy force. Force, therefore, is a conditioned energy. Force is energy which is being revealed or released by an aggressive motion or an aggressive procedure. Energy is moved into a forceful relationship with things. It is released by an action of the will. And the will, therefore, may be best explained, perhaps, much as Schopenhauer explained it, along Buddhist lines, when he points out that the will is the director of the use of energy, that the will itself is floated upon energy, and that in the accomplishment of its own purpose, will transforms energy into force. And that by which men live becomes transformed into that by which men do, or create, or fashion, or modify their own existence in relationship to other things. So the problem of life moving into the form of energy sets up the metaphysical universe. Energy moving into the state of force sets up the physical universe. Therefore, over the physical universe, the Greeks placed the Demiurgus, the deity Zeus, whose symbol was the thunderbolt, and who represents the principle of force used to bring forth an orderly condition, which is the empire of the gods. Force, therefore, is the prince of the material world against which Jesus turned. Force is that or a phase of man's energy expansion, by means of which he sets up his own kingdom in the abyss. Or, if we wish to be less thoughtful of that point and go into the Gnostic concept, it is force personified by a mental agent or ensouled by a mental agent that brings forth material creation. Therefore, the mind of the Demiurgus, or the mind of the world god, by the use of the thunderbolts which represent force, takes the primordial essence of the 12 Titans, the universal field of energy, and transforms this energy into force, and by force creates and then governs an area set aside for the manifestation of a world, a solar system, or a cosmos. Man, in turn, in miniature, reproduces this procedure. Thus we say that man may be a spiritually living creature, a mentally energized, and a physical creature operating and existing by virtue of force. Because it takes force to move the blood through the arterial system. It takes force to move the hand. It takes force to play the piano. It takes force to drive a nail. These things represent the activities of body. But this force is possible because the mind and the subtler inner life is energized and vitalized. And all this is also possible only because man is a living creature, and that life itself, in its manifestation, breaks up into energy and force and forms another creative triad on a lower level of manifestation from the benign triad. The next point that we wish to make here is of the nature of divine and human relationship. We can't take up the whole study of the 7 points of metaphysics, so we limited them to 4 in our announcement for the evening's work. Now we have a very interesting problem. You have a farmer who goes out and sows a field. And we will say now that the plants which he sows are going to be of great size, and that a jungle will arise where he has sown. Now this jungle is the result of his own sowing. But when it grows to its full maturity, man himself can no longer control it. He can no longer find his way through the jungle that he himself has sown. Therefore, we may say also that the seminal principles of existence sown in space by that eternal energy or essence which created the world finally results in the manifestation in space of a formal creation, the creation of suns and moons, of planets, and of asteroids and comets, and a vast and involved chemical situation which lies below the threshold of our common observance. This world in which we live is a mass chemical reactions, a mass of energy moving, a tremendous interplay of forces permeated throughout by life, and all of these different manifestations being grounded in essence, substance, and being. So that we have a very complicated procedure. And out of this strange earth into which the seeds of the infinite are sown, there finally grows forth man, who is of the earth, earthy, and whose creation is allegorically described in the formation of Adam. Man, therefore, is like all products born of seed, is alive. In his aliveness, he carries, rooted within the depths of himself, the full vast mystery of life. By his own very nature, he participates in that very nature which alone is. And in the course of his growth over a vast period of time, this creature, which we call man, has risen from a comparatively helpless and hopeless condition to one of highly developed resources, powers, and potential. So now we have the point of view shifted. Man has become capable of the experience of self-knowing, and he has also become capable of the experience of God-seeking. He finds himself standing in the presence of a mystery, enveloped by this mystery. Whichever way he turns, it extends from him in every conceivable direction. He finds that he exists within an infinite universe and that he is a very tiny and comparatively insignificant fragment of this universal totality whose body nature is and God the soul. So man, whether he is highly skillful or not, finds himself as an existence within existence. He finds, however, that his existence is restricted largely to the area of his own body, that he cannot escape from this body except by death, that he cannot be more than he is at any time, but that he does possess physically, morally, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually the power to grow. Confronted with this concept, the Gnostics, and to a measure, the Neoplatonists, developed what is called the system of aeonology. That is, they devised the idea of a twofold process taking place constantly in nature. The positive polarity of that process is the motion of the infinite toward finiteness. That forever heaven is moving toward the earth. That forever life is becoming embodied. That all spiritual things, like the angels described in the Book of Enoch, are coming down upon the mountains of the earth. That the gods are moving downward. That every force that is truly divine, the great creative processes are droppings, as Plato tells us, like tiny seed from the Milky Way, falling into the mystery of generation, ignorance, and death. These being merely terms for the obscuration of the essential consciousness of these lives. So the ancients felt that there was a great universal motion by which total being was moving inevitably toward the state of being totally embodied. At the same time that this is occurring, these seeds that were planted somewhere in the dark earth, the primordial growth and development, have been growing upward like plants from the surface of the earth. Therefore, man is a kind of plant growing upward. Man is rooted in the earth, and he is seeking to ascend to the sky. Eternity is rooted in the sky, and is suspended, as Plotinus tells us, like an inverted tree or flower, with its effulgent blossoms revealed through the nature and appearance of the stars. So we have two contrary forces in operation. Man, in a process of perpetual evolution, existing within a universe in which being is in a process of eternal involution. This combination means that being is continually permeating a or radiating like the sun. And man is continually seeking to ascend and be reunited through growth with the luminous source of himself. Thus, man is ascending a ladder of seven rungs, and eternity itself is descending through a world of 7 degrees, qualities, spheres, or parts. In the Gnosis, these were represented by emanationism, in which eternity is forever emanating the qualified or conditioned aspects of itself. And man is forever emanating the overparts of his own nature, which are his intuitional and inspirational elements or characteristics. Somewhere, these two meet. And it is the meeting of these two values by means of which heaven and earth are united. It is in this way that the two opposites are reconciled, and as the alchemist said, we produce the mystery of the fire that is fed by water, and the water that is not extinguished for the fire. So we have this common meeting. Man has body, mind, and spirit. The infinite must likewise have spirit, mind, and body. The body of man belongs to the body of the infinite. This is the mind of man is part of the mind of the infinite. The spirit of man is derived from the eternal essence of infinite spirit. Man has been so constituted that he can reach a degree of insight in which he can bridge this mysterious interval between the creating power and the created creature. So according to the old beliefs and the ancient traditions, there comes a time in which man becomes capable of regaining a point of equilibrium between creator and creation. And this interval between creator and creation is the abode of creature. And man is a creature. The word man is from the ancient Hindu Manas, the thinker. Manu, the lawgiver. So in the emanation theory, man ascending gradually approaches a condition of comprehension. Eternity descending comes gradually near enough to man so that man can comprehend this universal procedure. And it is because these two powers are moving toward each other by eternal law that man himself more or less comes into existence. Because man represents the creature which contains both the creator and the creation. As Paracelsus said, man is bound to the elements by his body, to the planets by his soul, to the stars by his spirit. So the spirit in man links him to the eternal. The body of man binds him to the temporal. Between these two, the soul of man, his mental and emotional coordination, acts as the bridge, so that the individual is capable of making the transition from the state of not knowing to the state of knowing. Because of all creatures which we are capable of knowing or comprehending ourselves, man is the only one in which there is a Homer's golden chain which locks the rock of earth and binds it to the pinnacle of Olympus. Man, therefore, has the chain of bodies, the chain of vehicles, without a break. And man is the lowest creation in which this is true. Therefore, man alone has a perfect ladder on which he can ascend, from the material to the mystical, from the mystical to the rational, from the rational to the divine. This constitutes his road or his path. And it was held in ancient metaphysics that it's because of this chain of vehicles alone that man is capable of understanding metaphysics. If he did not possess the internal instruments of knowing, he could not even wonder about the reason for himself. But because he possesses these, Plato points out that it is a shame indeed, a great pity under the sun, that possessing this power to know God, man should be willing to live in ignorance and die in ignorance. That having values, powers, and potentials by which he is lifted above all other creatures and has the means to attain union with the radiance of the infinite, that he is willing to remain a mole, clinging to the earth, burrowing within the earth, assuming his blindness to be his proper state, and denying expression continuously to these urges and impulses within himself, which would rebel against his own impotence and would impel him to seek his proper destiny, as described in the mysterious Gnostic hymn of the Robe of Glory. So that we have, in this situation, another point which metaphysics brings out. And that is the strange, incredible, unsolvable restlessness in man. The human being is never at peace, never at rest. They're never able to escape from the impulses and the pressures that tear him and, in one way or another, disturb him. The reason for this restlessness is that man's impulses, his life facts, his realities, and his energies, all belong to the infinite. Man's natural instinct is like that of the bird, to be free. He wants to rise into the higher air. He wants to spread the wings that have been concealed within the body of clay. He wants to go home. He wants to be part of the great citizenry of space by which he is wonderfully equipped and for which he is destined. Yet in the presence of this tremendous desire to grow, he finds, as Goethe says, that there is a self within him which in the earth aspires. There is something in him that binds him also to the trivial, holds him locked within the narrow confines of his earthly cage, and causes him to count as most blessed those situations which most affect him early and contribute to his misery. But man cannot rest because he belongs to the light. He belongs to the ancient road that must bring him finally to the full expression of infinite existence in himself. He must go home. He must be one with the infinite by becoming himself infinite. Thus he cannot endure with complete complacency that which frustrates the complete purpose for his own existence. Thus he is ill at ease. He cannot accept the condition in which he finds himself. He is too big for the world he has accepted and too weak to learn how to escape it. He cannot be satisfied with what he is, but he hasn't the courage to be more. Thus the disciplines of philosophy, the great schools set up in antiquity for the cultivation of human conduct, were intended to instruct man in his eternal destiny, strengthen him in his resolution to claim his proper birthright, and to provide him with the various instruments through the use of which he can achieve that end for which he was destined. These instruments, this process, this insight, and the science involved in the perfection of this part of man, these together constitute the subject of metaphysics. Thank you very much.